I know people in Montana feel bittersweet about this, but I think Montana is on the map as a destination for people and talent and capital.
This is Can Do, Lessons from Savvy Montana Entrepreneurs, a podcast that explores why Montana leads the nation in entrepreneurship and business startups. I'm Arnie Sherman. Will Price founded Next Frontier Capital in 2015, in part to reverse Montana's historic brain drain by giving tech startups the capital they need to stay in the state and to create jobs for the next generation of Montanans. The Montana native brings a wealth of experience to the state's investment landscape. Will served most recently as CEO of Flight, which in 2016 was acquired by Snap, the parent company of Snapchat. Before that, he was managing director at Hummer Winblatt Venture Capital, with earlier positions at Pequot Capital and Morgan Stanley. Today on Can Do Lessons from Savvy Montana Entrepreneurs, Will Price and I discuss the thinking behind Next Frontier Capital's 17 investments to date, the challenges regional venture funds face, and how startups can attract venture capital in today's marketplace. Production support for this Can Do podcast comes from the Dennis and Phyllis Washington Foundation, dedicated to investing in people to improve the quality of their lives, and from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communications on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans, and from Blackfoot, providing communication solutions for Montana businesses, plus opportunities like C2M Beta, an innovation lab aimed at helping startups thrive. C2MBeta.com. Welcome, Will Price.
Oh, thank you, Arnie. It's really great to be on your show.
Today's show is brought to you from Peak Recording in Bozeman, Montana. So, first off, Will, what is venture capital?
The way I think about it is that it's risk capital that invests in companies that by their nature aren't able to generate profits from the beginning of their operation. So if you open up a restaurant or a bar or a car detailing business, you know, the idea would be that you'd probably be able to borrow some money from the bank, generate profits, and start paying back both the loan, but also be able to earn profits for yourself. Venture capital supports a certain class of company that may take $3, $5, $10, $15, $100 million to be able to get to profitability and to build a business. And so venture supports these businesses that in absence of that venture would never be started because loans wouldn't find them creditworthy and they're far too risky for individual investors. And so, you know, famous examples are Google, Yahoo, PayPal, Square, Amgen, Intel, Oracle, Amazon. Really the companies that kind of define our relationship with technology, the products we use, the services we depend on, we're all backed by venture capitalists. I think I've read somewhere about a quarter of NASDAQ companies were venture backed. And so it's capital that's risky, but it supports the creation of companies where you may need to fund losses over years, if not decades, in order to be able to build a profitable company. But once you've done that, you build something truly valuable and worthy of both the consumers that benefit from it, as well as the investors who'd stand to gain from the creation of those products.
And why have you chosen this particular niche for your career?
Absolutely. Well, for me, I'm passionate about the creation journey. Like Peter Thiel wrote a book called Zero to One. And to me, that's a great way of quickly summing up what it means to be an entrepreneur. It means literally out of nothing, creating something that may change the course of your community, your country, certainly your industry. And people that are entrepreneurs that believe they have the audacity to take on that kind of challenge, I find just incredibly stimulating and inspiring to be around. They're not willing to take no as an answer. They're not willing to believe the status quo is acceptable. And they have, like, when I say the word audacity, I really do mean that, because it almost is crazy a priori to think that a couple people, three people, four people, one person in certain cases can start something that will fundamentally change the way we all live. And yet they don't view that as a the daunting challenge, as a reason not to do it. And so to me, I love being around that energy and that sense of optimism about what's possible. I also, for me personally, as someone who's always learning and fascinated like a polyglot about all kinds of subjects, venture allows you to be exposed to all kinds of different industries, different technology trends, markets, prices, strategies, distribution options. And so you're constantly being challenged to learn new things and process that information in ways that allows you to make investment decisions. And so both the people I'm exposed to and the ideas they represent to me are just really exciting to be around.
You went to Harvard. You studied Mandarin at Nanjing University. You got your MBA from Northwestern. From that experience, what prepared you the most for what you're doing now?
I would say there's very little kind of academic training. I think that makes venture possible. You know, it's not really that complicated on a finance basis. And so for me, I think what allowed me to have the exposure I had in Asia, I worked in Hong Kong, Singapore, Philippines, Thailand, Indonesia, Malaysia, India, Australia, and I looked at a lot of different types of industries. I think the ability to be open, to not have a fixed mindset, but open to possibility, different interpretations and perspectives on things, allows you to approach it. There's a great quote from Zen Buddhism about like, the beginner's mind. And I think some of my early career experiences and working in so many different cultures and business climates allowed me to keep a very open mind about how people operate and think. My first job in technology actually was when I was in business school. I worked for a company that made trading system software called Infinity Technology. It was sold to SunGard. And that was really what got me from just kind of a general business curriculum exposure through Morgan Stanley and through at Kellogg. Morgan Stanley is where I worked after I got out of Harvard and where I spent time in Asia, to thinking about technology and the applications of technology in various industries. And from that, I started a company in my late 20s, I should say, that was acquired by Pequot Capital, one of their portfolio companies specifically. And through that, they offered me a job working in investments, which is not something I'd really prepared or planned to do. And that really opened my mind and the opportunities for me to continue to work in the venture industry.
You mentioned all of these capital cities in the ASEAN region. Why are you in Montana rather than there, or in Silicon Valley, or in New York City, or in Connecticut, where Pequot is? How'd you decide to plant the roots here to do your VC fund?
Well, my father's name is Kent Price. He graduated from University of Montana in 1965, and his ancestor, Telefort Jacques Demers, came to Montana in 1858 and was quite the entrepreneur. He had mercantiles in Missoula, in Polson. He had a steamer that ran up and down the Flathead, and he had a hauling business that took stuff from Spokane into the Flathead Valley. And so my family, through my dad's side, has been to Montana since the 1850s. And my dad's father came to Montana he was born in Manchester, England, but came in the early 1920s and grew up in Anaconda, where he went to high school and then also went to the University of Montana. So I've had a lot of family history in Montana for a long time. And typically, a couple things have kind of made what I do now really particularly poignant for me. Our family has had a hard time staying in Montana. A lot of us have gone into the military. My dad, as an example, my grandfather, my great uncle. And the business environment, even though we descend from a great entrepreneur back in the 1850s and 60s, has always been a pretty tough climate. And so that's one part of the answer. The second part of the answer is this guy named Roger Lang, who lives here in Bozeman, Montana, was the founder of CEO of Infinity Financial that I mentioned earlier. And when he sold the company to SunGard, he bought a ranch in the Madison Valley called Sun Ranch, which is an incredible place. And so about 97, 98, I started visiting this part of Montana as opposed to the Flathead Valley. And I just fell in love with the Southwest Montana. And so we started coming up here and visiting. And when I was in my early 40s, my wife and I decided to move back to Montana with our children, who were approaching middle school and high school at that time. And so to me, I feel like there's this almost like this destiny of my ancestors and working entrepreneurship, and my, you know, males in my family and women in my family have had to leave the state because of lack of opportunity, a lack of access to economic opportunity, and then being reintroduced to a new part of the state through a friend. Really, what I feel like I'm doing now is a kind of a culmination of all those different trends in my life and themes, where we can invest in Montana entrepreneurs, create economic opportunity here in our state, keep people from leaving, and attract both human capital and financial capital to build businesses in ways that hasn't been possible previously. But we feel completely lucky and blessed to be able to live and work here. And so that's kind of a quick answer to why we're here now.
What challenges do you face being a regional venture capital fund based in Montana?
I'll take the regional capital one first. So in general, whether you're in Montana, Arkansas, you know, Madison, Wisconsin, there's a pejorative connotation as associated with regional venture capital. In fact, in many ways, people may argue it's an oxymoron. And the reason for that is that historically, the industry has been dominated by investments in the Bay Area, investments in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and the Massachusetts, and more recently in New York City, New York State, and perhaps in Washington, Texas. But the vast majority of the country has essentially been cut off from access to venture capital for a variety of reasons. And so institutional limited partners, and limited partners are the investors that invest in venture funds, it typically are endowments, you know, college endowments, pension funds, and other institutional investors that have pools of money that they want to invest over long periods of time. And typically about 3 to 5% of their total capital is invested in venture. historically, venture has seen returns only really from those major markets I described earlier. So if your investment thesis is to, by definition, not invest in California or Massachusetts or Washington State, but to invest within a small subsection of the country where there's not really previously understood examples of success, most institutional investors believe that's a losing strategy, that it's not possible to do that. And so the biggest challenge for any regional investor, let alone one from Montana, is that institutional investors do not believe it's possible to create returns outside of those major markets. In Montana, to just extend the concern, would be outside of Right Now Technologies and maybe Legasite, there aren't a lot of great examples of exits being realized here. And so when you're looking to raise money for a Montana venture firm, you know, based on what I said earlier, it's highly unlikely you'll see institutional support. Because of the lack of precedent in exits here, it's hard to see investors who are not from Montana seeing merit and value in it. So when we raised our fund, we targeted people who had three characteristics. First of all, they're people, not necessarily institutions. They're exposed to Montana, either they're from Montana or have come to love and enjoy and live in Montana. And they're high net worth people that believe in entrepreneurship and are willing to take risk. And so our funds, which we have two funds, a $21 million fund, which we raised in 2015, and a $38 million fund, which we raised last year, 70% of the investors are what I call Montana affiliated. They're people that fit that criteria I just mentioned. And then the balance are people that have worked with either me or my partners in prior lives and just believe in what we're doing and wanted to be part of it. I will like to call out the University of Montana. Their foundation has invested in both funds. It's our only institutional investor from higher education, and particularly grateful to their support for our funds.
Will you explain for our listeners what exits mean and why it's important for investors to consider exits?
Absolutely. Part of what exits allow is for wealth to be created, for that wealth to be recycled into subsequently new companies that are formed. But equally as important as the wealth, it's the experience that people get through an exit about what it's like to build a company from scratch, take a product to market, go public, successfully sell your company. And so exits, from an entrepreneurial ecosystem perspective, provide two really key inputs, capital and experience, that then create subsequent companies. And so when Right Now Technologies here in Bozeman, which was sold to Oracle, for $1.5 billion, I think, in 2012 or 2013, is an example of this seeding, if you will, of talent that can leave Right Now, having had real success, and go on to start companies. And I know the Chronicle's done a great case study on this, of how many companies have come out of the Right Now ecosystem. I think last time I saw it was about 20 companies. We have several in our portfolio investments that are populated by people that were at Right Now. Now, from a venture capital perspective, exits are the lifeblood of our industry. So the way a venture capital fund works is you raise money from limited partners and they make a 10-year commitment to the fund. And so it's a highly illiquid investment. It's a 10-year commitment. Typically, the first 2 or 3 years, you're investing the money in net new companies. And then the balance of the time, you're either supporting those existing companies through follow-on investments or just through board oversight. But ultimately, those limited partners want their money back. And so exits are the mechanism of liquidity in a venture capital fund. So you invest in a company in year one, you sell it in year seven, you're able to return the money to the limited partners, and they can either choose to then reinvest with you in a subsequent fund, take that money and, you know, use it to cater to their pension obligations or their own needs. But it's the cycling, if you will, the life cycle of money, where the exit is the ultimate means of providing capital back to your investors. So from an ecosystem perspective, exits are very important for the reasons I described. And for a venture capital firm, it's the reason we're in business, is to help our LPs, limited partners, be able to realize gain on their investments when companies are sold and we're able to return capital to them.
Exits is almost a misnomer. It's almost should be called beginnings, because as you pointed out, when the investors, they created 20 new companies as a result of that exit. What type of companies attract venture capital?
Well, venture capital companies typically are very strong intellectual property, where there's an invention that's the core basis for the company, and where venture capitalists believe that there's an opportunity to make 10 to 50 times their money on an individual investment. And the reason that's so important is that the loss rates on venture capital are extremely high. So unlike banks that maybe are looking for like a 2 to 5% non-performing loan ratio, I was reading this morning in Fred Wilson's blog, who's a famous venture capitalist in New York, that his wife's angel portfolio has a 50% loss rate. And so the loss rates are, 10 to 15 times more than you would probably imagine. And because of that, every discrete investment you make, in some sense, has to pay for all the other ones that aren't going to make it. So you're looking for investments that can yield extraordinary returns, that have technology invention that underpins them, that'll support the ability to withstand competition, because, you know, this world, we see good ideas are copied extremely quickly, and a market size that's large enough to support big businesses. And so, you know, you want to avoid overly niche or constrained markets that won't support companies that can get to very large revenue sizes. And then, you know, you have a team that is able to take an idea, translate its potential into a product, and then convince customers to part with hard-earned money to buy that product and deploy it in earnest. And so the venture firms kind of fit that profile. And as I said at the very beginning, one of the most important parts of venture capital investments are these are companies that by design, it's almost weird to say that when you're talking about business, are not going to be profitable at the beginning. They're not, the ultimate goal isn't profitability, but it's market penetration. It's, you know, growing your employee base to be able to support the opportunity with the confidence that if you are successful, ultimately it's going to translate into profits and revenue growth that delivers a margin for the investors. But it's not something that's an early condition, a strategy or a requirement.
Will, there's a lot of great ideas out there, but being a successful entrepreneur, you know, in my experience, is based more on operating the business after the startup phase. What do you think that requires?
Yeah, it's such a great question. And this is why venture is so hard and why it's so hard to reduce it to kind of truisms or rules of thumb. And the reason I say that is that you would assume that the people that are really good operators who know how to execute, like to your point, it's not so much the idea, it's translating the idea into a reality and then being able to grow it. And so typically you would assume that experience would be a requirement for success, because if you haven't been experienced in growing and running a business, how could you possibly do it? And yet, if you look at Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg and the founder of Instagram and Jeff Bezos at Amazon, who was a hedge fund guy, he went into the, you know, books business, experience isn't really correlated with their success. And so the ability to say, well, I'm looking for people who have prior track record of excellence in this discipline to support and invest in because they're more likely to be successful than people that haven't, obviously isn't a true one. Of course, there are great examples of mature people doing really good things, but it's almost become a cliche to think of the college dropout who goes on to build this great company. And so one of the things that I think that I've kind of agree with is someone once said that purity of motivation is a great predictor of success. And that is, like, why are people doing this? And getting into their life story, the original idea that they came up with, and the sense of passion they have within that idea that demands that they must see it through, almost independent of whether they're going to get paid for it or not. They just believe so importantly in that core idea. And so if experience isn't the measure by which you can judge people, you know, how else are you going to evaluate them? And so to me, it's come down to integrity, you know, willingness to be able to work with them, the fact that they're coachable and they listen to good feedback, but ultimately that they feel truly inspired. As I said earlier, the kind of audacity you need to be able to build something from nothing in the face of competition, challenge, inertia, all the things that keep people from doing things. These are truly motivated people. And that motivation has to be real. It has to be based on the fact that they really, truly believe this idea deserves to see the light of day, and not greed. Because greed isn't a sustaining motivation in the face of setback and challenge. And most businesses will go through a significant challenge at some point. And the entrepreneur will question, why am I doing this? Why am I, you know, foregoing pay and opportunity to work in a, you know, more established profession? And I'm, you know, working day and night and not sleeping and the stress level and all the things that go into running your own business. Well, what sees you through, I think, those times and come out the other side is really being inspired by a sense of mission and a belief that what you're doing is truly important. And so I really try to identify, you know, that as an intangible, because defaulting back to a resume that's full of accomplishment, even though it may be tempting to default to supporting people that have a track record of prior success, it certainly isn't indicative in our industry of the potential of untrained people or unexperienced people to go on and do great things.
You also help companies raise venture capital from other sources. So how does that role switch feel to you?
Yeah, it's a truly important part of what we do. And I'm very proud of that we've been very successful in that regard. And I'll just, you know, go briefly into it. So When I first thought about doing this fund, the reason I really was compelled to do it was I met so many entrepreneurs in Montana who complained quite rightly that there was a lack of equity capital available, risk capital available to build businesses. And really out of curiosity at the point in time, really more than anything else, I decided to look into how bad that really is in Montana. And according to PitchBook, which is one of the reference sites in our industry, there was about $3 million invested in the state in 2014. So last year in the United States, $99 billion was invested in venture capital in companies in the United States. So $3 million, you can see Montana, when they say it was hard to get access to money or there wasn't real money here, it's truly the case. Well, last year there was $83 million invested since we started our funds. And part of that is that we've been able to bring in firms like True Ventures, Venrock Ventures, Bessemer Venture Partners, Summit Partners, Amgen Ventures, BMWI Ventures, Toyota Research Institute, all have invested in Montana in our companies in the last few years. And the reason that's so important is, as I said earlier, sometimes it can take lots of money to get one of these companies to the market or to profitability. And even if we have, you know, a fund of $38 million now, it's really not even close to what it would require. If you do, say, let's say you do 10 companies per fund, that'd be less than $4 million per fund. If these companies are required $10 to $20 million to be able to get to a product to market and really flush out their idea, obviously we're not going to be able to carry that load on our own. So our ability to be able to identify companies that are compelling, put in initial rounds of capital, and then approach what I call the national venture firms that have the means to be able to help complete the equity needs of these companies is critical to our business model success, but as well to companies in Montana being able to truly, quote, make it. And what I've kind of come to realize is that the venture capital world has changed really significantly since I first started getting into it. There was a cliche in the venture that says, if you can't drive to it, don't invest in it. And the reason for that, I think, was that companies are very fragile in the early stage and require a significant amount of oversight, coaching, and support. So if the company's in Bozeman, Montana, or Madison, Wisconsin, or Chattanooga, Tennessee, and you're on the West Coast, that is hard to deliver. But what's happened in the venture capital industry is that these funds that used to be maybe $100 to $200 million 10 years ago are now $2 billion. And their ability to put that kind of money to work in their home market, in this case, the Bay Area market alone, is challenged. And it's forced them to become more national investors, more professional investors that are willing to take on national opportunities. And that's a huge reason why we've seen the investments we've seen in our companies from non-Montana firms. And yet the challenge then is, how do you evaluate a company from distance? It's really hard to be able to know who the people are or background the people or get some of the softer non-quantitative valuation metrics in place. So people default to numbers as a basis for evaluating risk from a distance. Now, numbers, what I mean by that is like revenue, cost of customer acquisition, lifetime value of a customer, how often your customers renew their contracts with you. And so they are, by definition, then if they have those metrics, not pure startups anymore. They're not concepts. These are operating businesses that have historical financials that support that kind of analysis. Well, that's all well and good, but the problem then becomes, as a kind of a national non-major market company, how do you fund a company to the point that will have these metrics that allow for this national analysis to occur, national from long distance analysis to occur? And what we've kind of worked out is that we think in the software industry, as an example, it may take you to $2 to $5 million to be able to get to a company that has the metrics and the track record for a big firm to be able to evaluate from distance. Again, numbers help them normalize risk because they can look at numbers as opposed to people or ideas. And so I think the reason that I'm so excited about regional venture capital is the following. A, it is now true that venture capital firms have material amounts of money and are willing to invest anywhere in the country. B, those companies require really meaningful metrics and traction to allow that analysis to occur. And C, because of that, you must have a local source of capital that will help companies go from concept to some level of proven execution and meet a minimum threshold of performance that allow those national firms to invest in regional deals. And so I think that I would expect to see more firms like ours being developed rather than less, because we're no longer going to create companies that are orphans. And what I mean by that is that if our companies are successful, it is now possible to raise money from major national investors, whereas 10 years ago may not have been. So even if you got the company started, it was probably more likely than not that you'd eventually run out of the local market's capacity to support that company. And there was no one at a national level willing to pick up the baton, if you will, in the relay race of company development. And now that's really changed. And so now I think we have a pure continuum of financing available to companies.
Well, there's a lot of money on the sidelines these days. I've heard there's more money than at any time in history. Why is that? Are there not enough creditworthy opportunities out there?
We talked about earlier about an institution that say they have $100 and they were going to put $3 in venture capital, where if you ask them about 10 years ago, about 30 of their dollars, 30 of the 100, so 30% would be in fixed income. And fixed income since 2009 has yielded very little, as you know, interest rates today. If you have money in a savings account or a CD account, you know, you're lucky to get 2%. And so the ability for big investors to be able to put money into fixed income as a source of making a balanced return is not there yet. So all of a sudden there's a question as well, where does all that money go? That's 10 times more money than the entire venture capital industry looking for a productive home. The second is equity markets. Equity markets have been a great place to put in money, but as you've kind of noticed through companies like Facebook and WeWork, they have stayed private way longer than historical companies have. It used to be that companies would go public within 4 to 6 year time frame of being started, but Facebook is a very famous example, didn't go public until it was worth, you know, tens of billions of dollars. Pinterest is going to go public this year, and you know, again, a very, you know, $10 billion plus valuation. Dropbox the same way. And so where the IPO market used to be provide an opportunity for institutional investors to get access to technology companies, that's no longer the case because they can stay private longer because there's such large amounts of money being invested in the venture industry. And so there's money that historically would have gone into public equities or fixed income that's going into what's traditionally we call alternatives. That's, you know, like private equity and venture capital. And just the sheer volume of that money is making it very easy for venture capital firms that have a track record to raise way more money than they've ever historically raised. And now the question is, how much is enough? Is it too much? Will it drive prices up and returns down? Will it saturate a market in ways that aren't productive and will lead to the destruction of capital? I think those are all questions that people are asking themselves. But there's no doubt that if you're an entrepreneur today, there's probably never been a better time to raise money. And there's never been so much money committed formally to the venture capital asset class than right here in 2019.
Well, historically, women have not been recipients of venture capital. Women run enterprises. Is that changing? And if it is, why is it changing?
Well, that's a great question. So I worked at Hummer Winblad, as you said earlier in the intro. Ann Winblad started Hummer Winblad, John Hummer, in 1989. And they were the first ever software-only investment firm, if you can believe it. Before then, people didn't really believe there was value in software as a discrete thing. It was systems, hardware and software. And so they saw the software revolution coming and got behind it. And I worked very closely with Ann. I was a partner of hers and very successful female. When I got into the venture industry in 2002, I think there was about, you know, maybe 2 to 4% of decision makers were women. Until about a year ago, that was the exact same number. And so the venture industry has been perhaps the worst industry I can think of in terms of representation of women in roles of responsibility, decision making, and leadership. It's taken significant numbers, I think, of scandals, of kind of faux pas where people are saying the wrong things in the industry, for the industry to kind of look at itself in the mirror and realize that not only are women underrepresented in the industry, but, you know, African Americans, other minority groups are not. And so it has become, I think, I'm on the board of the National Venture Capital Association. It is one of the number one things we work on now is trying to understand diversity, path to diversity, path to inclusion, path to opportunity for people that haven't historically had access to venture. Now, you can imagine the ripple effect of that. Like if 90 of 100 people are making decisions, you know, how many women-backed entrepreneurs are there going to be? And if a lot of venture capitalists have come from successful entrepreneurial careers, if women aren't allowed to or not able to get financing to have their own entrepreneurial experience, then again, that supply of talent is constrained unfairly. And so I think the baseline of where the industry is today, it continues to be unacceptable. I mean, I think it's, like I said, it's maybe 2 to 5% somewhere in there. All I can say is that there's more attention on the matter from the senior firms and the National Venture Capital Association that represents those firms to ameliorate and change that reality. But you're very right to point it out. I think Anne would probably be shocked to think that starting in 1989, that in 2019, all these years later, 30 years later, that it wouldn't be much better than when she was in the industry. I like to believe that the next 10 or 15 years we'll see significant change because I think there's so much spotlight on the issue and a recognition that, A, it's not appropriate, that it's certainly not representative of the opportunity set, but that there are these downstream kind of legacy effects of if there's all men making decisions, then female entrepreneurs who are the customer of venture capitalists in general are also probably not getting their fair shake. So it's a great point and one that deserves more attention.
Yeah, it's fair to point out that as conservative an institution as Congress in 1989 had less than 30 women as members, and this year there's 102. So Congress has tripled the number of women. It should have been in a shorter period of time, but at least they're making progress. The financial sector needs to belly up to the bar and make some changes themselves.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think it's something you'll start seeing limited partners put pressure on as well. Ultimately, they're the source of funds, and not to say that firms aren't receptive to the idea and look and working actively to make a hire, but I think you're right. I'll just talk about our portfolio for a second. We have 17 companies now. Only one of them is run by a woman, Laura Vades, who's the CEO of Onyx Map. So, you know, our own portfolio is not immune from the reality of how male-centric a lot of entrepreneurial activities are, and something that we spend a lot of time and attention on is making sure that we continue to support women-owned businesses as much as we can, and women-led businesses, I should say. But our own track record in that regard is not something I'm particularly proud of.
Let me switch gears a bit. I'm out there seeking venture capital funds. What are the biggest mistakes that a company makes seeking funding from you or from any of the other funds that are out there?
So the number one thing I see is entrepreneurs believing their ideas is this precious baby. You can't share it with anybody. You certainly can't tell anyone without signing an NDA about it.
NDAs or non-disclosure agreements are documents that are usually asked for by inventors or people that have proprietary information.
Yeah, and I think that's a real mistake. The odds of someone stealing your idea, running with it, and executing a business in competition with the original premise is highly unlikely. It's just too hard to build businesses that way. And in fact, almost the opposite. In my mind, the more you share the idea, the more you test it with potential investors, recruits trying to get people to come and join and work with you, and certainly customers who are going to pay for the product, the better that idea will be. And so two things I would say right off the bat. Don't ask for an NDA because it's unlikely a venture firm will give you one. And secondly, it shows a little bit of a misunderstanding of where the true value is going to come from. It's not from a PowerPoint deck or, you know, a document. It's from bringing to life that idea in ways that are extremely hard and difficult. And it's the execution of the idea that really has the value. And the second one is that typically I would wait at least 6 months of testing that idea with customers and potential employees before you share it with a venture capital firm. And inevitably, the idea, once it meets reality, like any good plan, there's all kinds of cliches about this, will change. Customers will tell you, well, that's kind of interesting, but I really kind of need it to do, you know, a few things 20 degrees to the left or right of your core vector. Or they'll tell you, that's a terrible idea, but I think this may be interesting. And the more you stress test it, the more refined, the more closer to actual value you'll be able to get it. And so if you can test your idea, share it wildly, and don't be so proprietary about it, spend time in the marketplace before you talk to a venture firm. Those are all things that I think are really important. And then understanding whether your business is venture backable or not is another thing too. Some ideas are by their nature eligible for venture and others are probably not. How would you know the difference? Well, I would say, you know, is your idea tied to some core technical invention? Is it highly differentiated, not from a concept level, but that fundamentally there's an invention at the heart of it that supports it? Is it really high margin? You know, in the field, will it be an 80 plus gross margin business? And, you know, is it serving a large market with international customers and both national and international customers? And those are just some early ideas.
How long does it take to raise venture capital?
I generally tell people it's going to take you 3 to 6 months to raise venture money once you're committed to the process.
Well, can you walk us through one of your successful investment raising scenarios?
Sure. Of 17 companies so far, we have one company that's been sold successfully, a company called Atata. Atata was an email security and data security company sold to Mimecast. So ultimately, that's the true definition of success. It's like a product that was brought to market in a larger company. In this case, Mimecast is a roughly $3 billion public company. So,
Will, you just proved an earlier point that you made about great enthusiasm for learning about different industries and different topics. Let me ask you finally, what does the future look like for Will Price and for Next Frontier Capital?
Thank you. That's a great question. First of all, I really enjoyed the conversation, and I know people in Montana feel bittersweet about this, but I think Montana is on the map as a destination for people and talent and capital. And I mean that across the full seniority spectrum, whether you're people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. People are coming to Montana because they see Montana as a, you know, to use a cliche, as the last best place, perhaps a place where you can live and work and do really great things in a community, access the outdoors in ways that aren't possible in many other markets. With that inbound of talent is coming capital as well. And so I fully expect to see Montana continue to be a net importer of talent, and the brain drain we alluded to earlier to, if not arrest fully, be mitigated by the fact that there are opportunities to stay here. People still may want to leave in the first 5, 6, 7, 8 years of after college and get some different experiences, but the ability to come home and not compromise your career potential, not compromise the academic investments you've made in terms of your skill set and your knowledge, and find work that is worthy of you, I think will only continue to improve. I think what it means practically for us as a firm is that we will raise Fund 3 at some point, and that'll either be, you know, similar size or maybe larger. We'll continue to seek high-quality investment opportunities here in the state. One of the things we did in Fund 2 is we added Colorado as a destination for us in terms of where we focus. And we have 3 companies that operate in Colorado. A 4th operates in Colorado and in Montana. And I think we'll continue to spend time in Colorado and neighboring Rocky Mountain states along the thesis that we described earlier, which is that we want to find companies that aren't concepts, that are real companies that may have raised some money but aren't yet at the level of performance or achievement that'll attract the major venture firms and are looking for that incremental bump in capital that can take them from, let's say, $100,000 a year in revenue to $1 million or $1.5 million in revenue or $2 million in revenue, where the national firms then do become interested. And so I like to see us build our capital base. I like to see us build our team. You maybe expand our geographic footprint in terms of coverage, in terms of the markets we look at. But fundamentally, our mission started here in the state, and we want to continue to be the investment partner of choice for the great Montana entrepreneurs that are out there who are looking to raise money and looking for a long-term partner to help build a successful business. And I feel like we've come off to a great start. The kind of single thread here is like talented people wanting to create opportunity here, wanting not have to leave, and not having to compromise whatever talents they have in order to, if they do decide to stay and live really fully fulfilled, exciting lives, that Montana isn't a negative in that life, but it's an enabler and a positive that makes what they do even more special.
Will, thank you for being on the show today. Thank you for being back in Montana. And it's exciting to hear that you're continuing the family legacy.
Thank you, Arnie. I really appreciate being on the show.
I appreciate your listening to Can Do Lessons from Savvy Montana Entrepreneurs, produced by Autumn Barnes and Beth Ann Austin in association with Montana Public Radio. For comments, recommendations for future guests, or general information, please go to mtpr.org. There you can also find previous guests' contact information and content from all our shows. Listen next time to Can Do, and our guest will be Brian Morgan of Adventure Life, discussing his adventure travel company and the hot destinations of 2019. I'm Arnie Sherman, wishing you peace and prosperity. Production support for this Can Do podcast comes from the Dennis and Phyllis Washington Foundation, dedicated to investing in people to improve the quality of their lives, and from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communications on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans, and from Blackfoot, providing communication solutions for Montana businesses, plus opportunities like C2M Beta, an innovation lab aimed at helping startups thrive. C2MBeta.com.